calmed down and what he had in his flight bag, guns and maybe drugs. She concentrated on what she was doing, as Jason continued to smile at her as though he didn't have a care in the world. "It's been nice flying with you," she said to him, and he nodded. She saw him pat something in his pocket and prayed it wasn't a gun. They were almost home. Just a few more minutes and they'd be down. "Nice flying with you too, Captain," he responded. "This might just be the best flight of my life," he said. And then he laughed. Chapter 9 Tom was acutely aware of the motions of the plane as he chatted with Catherine. She was infinitely more relaxed, knowing that the flight was almost over. And she was excited about her meeting. He could tell that she had no sense that anything was wrong, while Tom wondered why they were circling and hadn't been brought in yet. He didn't want to go back to the cockpit and ask. It could have been normal maneuvers dictated by the tower due to traffic into SFO. Or maybe there was some other reason to keep them circling, while emergency vehicles on the ground got ready. He knew that Homeland Security wanted to keep it quiet, in order not to start a mass panic in case it all turned out to be nothing. But he thought their approach to the airport was taking forever. He had seen Jason leave the cockpit, looking annoyed a while earlier, and saw that he was gone for quite some time. He used the first-class restroom, but he seemed happy when he came out. There was no sign of anything odd happening, or Tom would have gone forward. In the meantime, Catherine was easy to talk to, and he actually liked her. She had told him something about her job on Wall Street, and how hopeful she was about the interview in venture capital. And he decided to ask her the question on his mind before the end of the flight. If he didn't, he might not see her again. He apologized before he even began. "I hope you don't think me rude for asking." He smiled at her, and she liked the way his eyes lit up when he did. "I assume you're not married, since you talked about breaking up with a boyfriend recently." "No, I'm not." She smiled at him. "And now that you mention it, are you?" "Not lately." He was relieved when he heard the landing gear grinding, and they came down in altitude slightly. He thought it was a little early for the landing gear, but not alarmingly so. He was finally attuned to the plane, and for once she wasn't. "Actually, I haven't been married in a long time. I'm divorced," he confirmed. She was happy to hear it. So the absence of a wedding ring had been an honest statement of his status, not merely an oversight or a hoax. "Do you have kids?" he asked her, sincerely interested in knowing more about her. They had both worked on their computers for so many hours that they hadn't had more time for conversation. "No, I don't. I kind of missed that opportunity. I've never been married. Not that that seems to matter these days. I have a lot of friends who aren't and have children, their own or adopted. Being single is no longer a reason for not having children. I've just been too busy with my career for the last 20 years and dating people I didn't want to marry, or who didn't want to marry me. I turned 40 this year, and I suddenly realized that I was kind of over it. So I decided to do the things I've wanted to do but never got around to, like this job in California. I have no reason to stay in New York. I have no family there, no kids in school, no husband or boyfriend. I'm a free woman," she said, and she looked like she enjoyed her life. "I was thinking that I'd like to see you again before you go back to New York. Would you have time for lunch or dinner or a drink?" She looked pleased by the invitation but qualified it. "I'd like that, but I'm going to be staying down in Palo Alto." "I think I can manage to get down there," he said, undaunted. "It's about 40 minutes out of the city. Or we could spend the day in San Francisco on Saturday, and I'll drive you back. Whatever you can manage." "I'll be free after tomorrow. I left time for a second interview if they like me. I'm free on Friday and Saturday. I'm flying back on Sunday." "That works well for me. Why don't I come down to Palo Alto for dinner on Friday night? And if all goes well, we can spend the day together on Saturday. I'll pick you up if you like," he offered. "Goes well as in if I don't slurp my soup or start a food fight in the restaurant?" She was in good spirits, having survived the flight without incident. She always expected the worst to happen whenever she got on a plane, but it never had, and her fears were always unfounded. "Something like that," I was thinking more along the lines of, if you don't think I'm a jerk by the end of dinner, you never know how first dates will go. I've had a lot of them, she said. I'm a pro. He laughed at her and noticed that they were coming down slowly from their cruising altitude. Helen was handling the plane smoothly, which was to be expected, although some military pilots had rougher styles than others. Tom was fervently hoping that their concerns would turn out to be needless. It was beginning to look that way. The flight was almost over and nothing had happened. Catherine jotted down the name of her hotel then and handed him her business card so he would have her cell phone and email. And he gave her his. Nancy saw the exchange as she walked past them and smiled to herself. She was right. Something was starting between them. They had both been easy passengers, despite Catherine's nervousness in the beginning. "I'll call you tomorrow to see how the interview went," Tom promised, and he looked out the window to see how they were doing. Nancy was checking that all the passenger seats were in the upright position and they had their seatbelts on, and she stopped to see that the two children, Nicole and Mark, were strapped in and doing fine. "We're going to see our grandma soon," Nicole said to her with a big smile, minus her two front teeth. They had been angels on the flight, unlike the screaming baby and coach. "She's meeting us at the airport, and then we're going to call our mom." Her brother was looking out the window as Nancy moved on to the seat in front of them, where the Saudi couple was seated. He appeared not to be speaking to his wife while she tried to reason with him about something. Nancy saw that she had taken her long gray coat off and was wearing jeans and Nikes. She was talking to him, but he was not responding. He seemed to have other things on his mind as he looked out the window with a pensive expression, and Nancy went back to the galley. She could hardly wait for the flight to end and for her husband's flight to land from Miami. They had a lot to talk about that night, plans to make, and a decision to face about the 2-year-old girl in China. Nancy didn't know what she wanted to do about it. And Joel was reading a Martha Stewart wedding planner he had taken out of his flight bag as they got ready to land. Their work day was almost over, and their private lives were waiting for them at home. And when she glanced into first class, Nancy could see that Susan Farrow had put on a big straw hat and dark glasses. She had told the flight attendants she'd chatted with that she hated to be recognized when she traveled, because she liked to wear comfortable old clothes and didn't want to have to wear makeup and look glamorous. Nowadays, anyone could snap your picture with a cell phone, and it would turn up on the Internet, and she'd look awful. She had already put her little dog in his carrier, ready to deplane and make a quick exit. A representative of the airline was meeting her at the gate to accompany her to her car. The flight attendants had gotten a confirmation on it, and she would be first off the plane as a VIP traveling with them. And in the cockpit, Helen got clearance to make her final approach to SFO. She dropped their altitude for a smooth descent and noticed Jason staring at her. He indicated the controls on his side stick next to his seat. They each had one to fly the plane. "That'll be it, Captain. Thanks for a nice flight. You can turn the controls over to me now and switch off yours." For a minute she thought he was kidding the way he said it, or hoped he was. She almost thought they had escaped the problems that Ben had feared. "I'm landing the plane, Jason," she reminded him quietly in a neutral tone. "Actually, you're not. I am," he said, and switched the controls over to his seat. As he did, she flipped a small switch on her side stick he didn't notice, which would allow air traffic control to hear everything that was happening in the cockpit on an ongoing basis. He didn't see her do it. He was so intent on taking over the plane, and she didn't fight him for the controls, so as not to destabilize the plane, as he made a sharp turn and headed north, in the opposite direction from the airport. The tower came on instantly and asked her what she was doing. But they had already been alerted that any change in flight plan was to be reported immediately to Homeland Security. It was the only warning they'd been given, and controllers on duty noticed the change as soon as Jason took control. "What do you want me to tell them?" Helen asked Jason, and he thought about it for a minute, and she knew that the tower could hear her ask the question, which would alert them to the fact that she was not flying the plane and someone else was. "Tell them you're doing another loop around, and you aren't ready for landing." She did as she was told, as she saw Connor get up from his seat out of the corner of her eye, and wondered if she'd been wrong to warn him about Jason. But Jason saw him, too, as he set a straight course for the Golden Gate Bridge, and then turned toward the senior pilot and took a gun out of his pocket, where he'd concealed it. It had taken longer to assemble than it had when he'd practiced before, but it was functional now and had a silencer on it. He pointed it at Connor and spoke to him in a harsh voice. "Get back in your seat, and don't do anything stupid. You're a lunatic. You know that, don't you? You'll never get away with it." "Really?" Jason said in an icy voice. "Watch me." And with that, he shot Connor in the chest and stomach. Air traffic control could hear a pop, but not loud enough to be heard outside the cockpit. Jason lowered their altitude considerably. Connor Gray dropped to the floor instantly after he'd been shot, his uniform quickly soaked in blood. "Stay calm," Helen said to Jason. "I'm going to go and help him. You don't need the gun. You have control of the plane now." She got up carefully from her seat, and Jason didn't try to stop her. He was intent on where he was headed. Helen got to Connor as quickly as she could, took off her own jacket and tried to slow the flow of blood, but he was badly injured and having trouble speaking. His eyes looked deep into hers, and she tried to reassure him. "You're going to be okay. We'll be on the ground soon." She made him as comfortable as she could and went back to her seat next to Jason. The tower was demanding to know again what they were doing and where they were going. Neither Helen nor Jason answered, and the tower was insisting they come in and warn them of air traffic just below them if they intended to drop altitude again. Helen looked out the window and could see a large plane just beneath them. "Watch out for that plane," she warned him. "You're not going to be able to pull this off. You know that, don't you? If you give me back the controls now, I'll get us down safely. You can keep me as a hostage if you need to when we're on the ground." "What are they going to do? Shoot me down? Fire a missile at us? They can't. We have 102 passengers and 9 crew on board. They're not going to endanger them. And you don't need to be a hero, Captain. Who gives a damn about these people?" he said confidently. He was on a joyride he had waited years for, and nothing was going to stop him. "You don't want to hurt anyone, Jason," she said firmly, but he already had. Connor Gray was dying on the floor behind him, and it was obvious where they were going. They were headed for the Golden Gate Bridge, just as Ben had feared would happen. Nothing was going to stop Jason now. The tower had alerted Homeland Security immediately, who called their local chief, who in turn called Ben in New York. He was still watching the rescue teams at the Golden Gate Bridge. Ben put him on speaker the moment he got the call. "He's got the plane," Alan Wexler told Ben from San Francisco. She flipped the switch on the radio. "Air traffic can hear everything. He shot someone. It must be Captain Gray, because Captain Smith is still talking. They're headed for the bridge now." "Shit," Ben said, listening to him, and he turned to Phil. "Where's Tom Burney? Email him and tell him to get in there. If Smith tries to get the controls away from Jason Andrews, he'll shoot her." "He's going to shoot one of them, whatever happens," Phil predicted grimly. He emailed Tom Burney then, but got no response. Tom was already aware that something had happened when they dropped altitude sharply and nearly hit another airliner. He looked at Catherine for an instant and spoke to her quickly. "Everything's going to be fine, but it may get a little scary for a while. Trust me, you'll be okay, I promise." And with that, he took off for the cockpit at a dead run, sped down the aisle, and took the access codes out of his pocket. People were leaning into the aisle to try and figure out what was going on, and both groups he ran past in the galleys looked panicked. He stopped for only a second to talk to the purser, told her the captain had given him the access codes, and he had the security clearance to go in. And she'd seen him go into the cockpit earlier, so she knew it was true. Seconds later, as people looked down the aisle to watch him, Tom unlocked the cockpit door easily with the codes Helen had given him, and he crouched down as he crawled on all fours, let the door close behind him, and saw Connor Gray immediately. He was ashen and bleeding profusely, and Tom could hear Helen speaking to Jason in a calm, even voice, trying to get him to allow her to take the controls over again. They couldn't compete back and forth with the controls. They were flying over the bay by then, over container ships and tankers, and Tom could see the bridge in the distance, with the Coast Guard ships near it. He stood up then, trying to distract Jason from Helen. Jason turned to face Tom, standing behind him, and pointed the gun at him. "You don't need to shoot me, Andrews," Tom said calmly. "You don't need to do any of this. Let's go home." "Fuck you!" Jason shouted at him. "How did you get in here?" "My security clearance gives me the access codes on any plane I want." He didn't want Jason to suspect Helen, or he might shoot her for that. "Let's take the plane back to the airport." They were losing altitude, but not at a rapid rate. They still had room to maneuver, and he knew Helen could do it. "Put the gun away. You don't need it." "Yes, I do. Fuck the bastards I work for. They'd have had me in the number two seat forever. They don't like my attitude," he said in a mocking tone. "I hate them. There's no reason to kill a bunch of innocent people for it. What difference does it make? At least they'll have had a thrill before they die. No one gives a damn about them." Helen did, and Tom, and the airline, and Ben and his whole office in New York, and Allen's in San Francisco. They had been working frantically for hours to protect them. The tower radioed to all planes in the area that they had a rogue plane in the air believed to be headed toward the Golden Gate Bridge, and suggested they gain altitude and to watch for visible air traffic. The tower warned them all to use great caution and to stay away from the bridge. At the same time, the San Francisco Office of Homeland Security was warning all emergency vehicles to be on the alert. The plane was heading toward them, and probably the bridge. And the FAA had just been informed that the captain was no longer in control of the plane, and a rogue pilot was flying it. Jason was still using the controls on his side stick, while Helen sat watchfully beside him, waiting for an opportune moment to switch them to hers before they got to the bridge. And Tom knelt to tend to Connor, who was gasping for air, as Tom loosened his collar and tie, which was all he could do for him. Tim Shepard, Helen's father, had just left the hardware store with a new power drill and some shelves he wanted to put in his younger grandson's room. He heard the news as soon as he turned the key in the ignition. He had left the radio on the news channel, and all the announcer said was that a plane, a commercial airliner, was flying in the San Francisco area out of normal flight plan, and the possibility that it was being piloted by terrorists had not been ruled out. Tim stopped, frozen in his seat, and glanced at his watch. It was 10:47, and he knew Helen's flight was due to land any minute. His blood ran cold as he listened, and some terrifying instinct told him it was the plane Helen had flown in from New York. She had called him from New York the day before and asked if he wanted to have lunch with her. She said she'd be home by 1, and as he often did, he told her he'd do some repairs around her house while he waited for her to get home. Since retiring from the Air Force, he spent all his spare time with his daughter and grandchildren. His son-in-law's shocking death had convinced him that Helen needed his help. She couldn't do it all alone. He had been one of the most dedicated pilots in the Air Force in his day, and had given Helen her love of planes. He was immeasurably proud of her. She was his only child. And as he sat listening to the news in the car, the announcer said that the plane had been sighted heading for the Golden Gate Bridge. They didn't identify what flight it was, but as soon as they said the airline, he knew. "Come on, Helen," he said out loud without even realizing it. "Whatever's going on up there, you can do this. Get your plane back from those bastards and take control." He was clenching his jaw as he said it and fighting back tears. He put the car in gear then and sped toward his grandchildren's school. Whatever happened next, they were going to need him more than ever, and he wanted to be there when they heard the news. "God damn," Ben said, stomping around his office, as everyone made calls to try and get information. "Couldn't I be wrong for once? Here we go again. What the hell are we going to do to help her get that lunatic away from the controls? And where the fuck is Tom Burney?" "He's in the cockpit with them. The tower can hear him. Tom gave Andrews some song and dance about having the access codes as part of his clearance, but at least Jason hasn't shot him or Helen yet." "That's something," Allen said miserably on the speakerphone. "The passengers must be panicking," Ben said, thinking aloud. We have a good crew up there. They know what to do. Jennifer, the purser, made an announcement for all passengers to stay in their seats when the plane had started to drop. She told everyone to put their life vests on and where to find them, and reminded them not to inflate them while they were inside the aircraft. Susan Farrow had put her dog inside her sweater, with his leash in her hand, and had put the life vest over both of them. And Nancy and Joel were on their jump seats, holding hands. "I'm not letting whoever is flying this plane ruin my wedding. I can't do that to Kevin," he whispered to her. And they both knew that if the plane went down and they hit the water, they'd have to move fast. They had no idea what was happening, but it wasn't good. Jennifer kept making announcements for everyone to keep calm and to be ready for a possible water landing. She reminded them again to pull down on the red tab on their life vests only after they left the aircraft. When Nancy leaned into the aisle, she could see people holding hands, and some were crying. No one was screaming yet. She felt bad for the two kids traveling unaccompanied, but didn't dare move out of her seat. And Catherine James was looking panicked. By then, everyone knew that something terrible had happened, and something even worse might come next. Jason was grinning, with the bridge in plain sight by then, and Helen knew she had almost no time left to save them. Tom was sitting in Connor's seat, who was lying at his feet, and making no sound. Helen turned to look at Tom and nodded imperceptibly, and he understood. This was going to be their last chance. In a few minutes, they would be there. Tom got up quietly from his seat, and on silent feet, took two big steps to Jason, who was looking straight ahead at the bridge. And Tom hit him as hard as he could on the side of the head. It stunned Jason for just long enough to loosen his grip on the side stick with the controls next to his seat. Helen flipped the switch on him and took control of the plane again as Jason leapt out of his seat and pointed his gun at Tom. "You son of a bitch!" he shouted at him. "You're just like all the rest, the lying bastards at the airline, my cheating girlfriend. You're all liars and cheats trying to screw me over!" he yelled at Tom, but he didn't pull the trigger. Helen tried to regain altitude as she pulled a sharp maneuver and alternately dipped the wings. She was trying to throw Jason off balance and get the gun out of his hands so Tom could get it away from him. "Sorry, Tom," she said, as she dipped the wings as sharply and extremely as she dared. It was a tactic she had learned as a fighter pilot, and it had always worked, but she needed more altitude to do it right. She knew she was terrifying the passengers, who had no idea what was happening. But it worked well enough. Both men were knocked off their feet, and the gun fell out of Jason's hands as he tried to steady himself, and Tom got him in a grip and held him down, while Helen tried desperately to regain altitude. But he had taken them down too far. She could hear screaming in the back from the passengers, but there was nothing she could do about it, except steady the plane, and try and pull it up. It looked like she was going to make it, and the zigzag course of the aircraft was on CNN by then, and they saw her breathtaking maneuver alternately dropping the wings that had gotten the gun out of Jason's hands while she continued to wrestle with the plane. "I can't get us up any higher," she said through clenched teeth. "The goddamn plane is too heavy, and he's got us down too low," she said to Tom, and she flipped the radio switch again so she could talk to the tower while Tom held Jason down with his full weight so he couldn't move. "This is Captain Helen Smith," she said calmly. "We have a problem." "We can see that you do. Who's flying the plane now?" "I am, but I'm having trouble getting back upstairs. Can you land in the Presidio? There's some flat land there. It's to your left." "I'll see what I can do," she said, but didn't sound convinced. The air traffic controller told Homeland Security what he had suggested to her. Amanda and Bernice were holding hands in a death grip as they watched the progress of the plane on CNN, and Ben stared at it in horror. They were still heading toward the bridge, and he knew Helen must be fighting the plane with everything she had to change their course before too late. And as Ben watched the television screen in New York, Jason succeeded in throwing Tom off him with a burst of superhuman strength and fought Helen for the controls again. Tom had hit his head and was dazed. Jason was able to get control of the plane away from Helen and headed it straight for the bridge. Everyone watching from the ground could guess that Jason was back in the driver's seat again. It looked like the inevitable was about to happen. And as Jason shrieked with laughter, Tom picked up the fallen gun and aimed it at him. Chapter 10. There was silence in Ben's office as they watched the progression of the plane, low over the water, and heading for the bridge. No one was telling them anything from the cockpit. Helen was too busy trying to figure out how to get the plane away from Jason and save the passengers. But Tom had the gun, and Jason didn't know it. Jason was in a state of euphoria, watching them head straight for the bridge. This was what he had planned, and it was happening. It was the most exciting thing he'd ever done, and he'd done it right. He knew Helen couldn't save the plane or get them out of the nosedive they were in, and he had timed it perfectly. They would hit the bridge, the plane would explode, and what was left of it would fall into the water and sink, and the bridge with it. Everyone on the plane would be dead, and the airline would be embarrassed and have to pay millions of dollars in lawsuits, maybe billions. He didn't care who died, just so they all did. And he had nothing to live for now anyway. They were never going to let him fly as a captain now. They weren't going to anyway, and he was going out with a bang. He was taking a national landmark with him. They would never forget the pilot who had destroyed the Golden Gate Bridge. They would remember him forever, just like the postcard said. He had left it in the bin on purpose, even though no one would know what it meant until afterward. He was savoring every minute, and suddenly felt the gun pressed against his head. "Get out of that seat," Tom said in a murderous voice. "I mean it. Get up." "Why should I?" Jason said, smiling at him. "We're all going to die together." "No, we're not," Helen said clearly. She reached down and switched the controls back to herself as Tom dragged Jason out of the chair, and Jason didn't try to stop him. He knew it was too late for her to save them. His mission had been accomplished. "Captain Smith here," Helen said to the tower. They had been listening, too, and watching the plane's erratic movements as they helplessly stood by. "It's too late to get us out of this. We're going down," she said in a matter-of-fact tone. And as she said it, Jason grabbed the gun from Tom with an enormous smile on his face, put it in his own mouth, and pulled the trigger. Blood splattered everywhere, and Jason fell to the floor dead. He had wanted to commit suicide, and he had done it. Helen looked through the blood-splattered windshield, trying to figure out what to do and where to land. She couldn't make it into the Presidio, but she was determined not to hit the bridge, and she knew that if she pulled up now, she would. "My co-pilot is dead. He shot himself," she said, and then turned to Tom. "Get back there, and have the crew get everyone out as fast as they can once we're on the water. I'll do what I can, but we won't float for long." Tom nodded, and she stopped him for a second. "How's Connor?" They hadn't heard a sound from him in several minutes while they dealt with Jason. Tom looked down before he left the cockpit and answered her. "He's dead." She nodded. She couldn't stop to think about it. She had a plane to land on the water, for as long as it would float. "Go," she said to Tom, with urgency in her voice. "We have very little time to get them out. If I can keep it up for long enough, the slides will be operative," which would turn into life rafts. There was a slim chance that they could save the passengers, but she was going to try, and she was determined not to hit the bridge. She knew that if she tried to gain altitude from the course Jason had set them on, they would hit the bridge for sure, and there would be less chance of survivors. "Captain, the Coast Guard is ready for you," the tower told her. "I don't know if I'm ready for them. I can't get up, so I'm going down. I'm going to try to slide under the bridge. We may lose a few repeat customers on this maneuver. They may pick another airline after this," she said to the controller, concentrating on what she was doing and trying to bring the aircraft in on a dime. It would put them in the choppy waters at the mouth of the bay, but she had no other choice now. She was in the cockpit alone with two dead men, and she was damned if she was going to lose a single passenger, whatever it took. Tim had made it to his grandchildren's school by then, and without hesitating, He strode to the principal's office. She was just coming back after a meeting, and he told her what was happening. The news had said it was a flight from New York, but admitted that there were two flights due in from New York within a half an hour of each other, and they didn't have a confirmed flight number for this one. "Are you sure it's Helen's flight?" the principal asked, looking shocked. She had seen him at the school before, picking the kids up from sports games and after-school activities. He had an active role in their lives, and he shook his head in answer to her question. "No, I'm not sure, but I'll be stunned if it isn't. She was due in now, on a flight from New York. I'd like to get the kids out of their classes. I don't want them seeing or hearing about this from someone else." She nodded agreement. "I'll have them brought to my office right now." And within minutes, he had his arms around them in the principal's office. There was a TV in the room, and he had turned it on and was watching his daughter's last desperate maneuvers to save the plane and fly under the bridge. He knew what she was doing, and it was a daring move. "Is Mom going to be okay?" his younger grandson asked as all three children stood watching with them. The principal left the room out of respect for them and what the children were seeing. Possibly their mother's death in the next few minutes, and that of many other people when the plane went down.
"She'd better be," Tim said in a hoarse voice. "Your mom is a hell of a fine pilot," he said, as tears rolled down his cheeks and the children clung to him like barnacles. "If anyone can pull this off, she will," he said, willing her to succeed, at least at saving the passengers and herself. He didn't give a damn about the bridge or the plane. All he wanted was for his daughter to come out of it alive. Her children needed her, and so did he.
Ben and everyone in the New York office had a perfect view of what Helen was doing from the camera in the news helicopter that was shooting live footage for TV. It was the same scene Helen's children and her father were watching in Petaluma at their school.
"Oh, my God, what's she doing?"
Ben could see that she couldn't bring the plane up. It was too late. And the only thing she could do was a water landing, but the plane would sink fast when she did. Phil was pacing. Amanda was speechless. Bernice was crying. All she could think of was Toby, and how she would feel if they were on that plane and about to die. It looked like a long shot for Helen not to hit the bridge, keep the plane floating long enough, and get everybody out. Possibly only a few would be saved, those closest to the exits, or maybe none at all. Dave hadn't said a word since Jason got control of the plane, overshot the airport, and headed for the bridge. He'd never seen anything like this, and didn't want to again. It had been the most stressful day of his life. Ben understood what Helen was trying to do by then, and he didn't think she could pull it off. It was a stunt kids had done in small private planes, daredevils, show-offs. Trying to fly under the bridge in an aircraft that size was insanity. But what other choice did she have? If she didn't go under it, she would hit the bridge. Nancy had made the announcement as soon as Tom came out of the cockpit covered in blood, and told her Helen's instructions. She told the passengers they were going to make a water landing, reminded them again how the life vests worked, and said they were going to have to move fast as soon as the plane touched down. The crew would help them, but the plane couldn't float for long. She wondered for an instant what this would do to her baby, but she couldn't think about that now. Tom got to his seat and grabbed Catherine's arm. "I want you out as soon as we hit the water. Do you understand?" She nodded and looked at him, too frightened even to panic. "What happened?" He was covered in Jason's blood, but unharmed himself. It was a gory sight. "I'll tell you later." The crew members were shouting to everyone to remove their shoes and take crash positions, which they all did, too terrified not to. As Tom glanced out the window, he saw them heading straight for the bridge. And by some miracle, Helen pulled the plane down just enough, leveled it barely above the water, and flew it under the bridge, close enough to touch it. Skimming the choppy waves beyond it, they glided on top of the water and came to a stop. Tom knew that was their cue, and so did the crew. They opened all the doors and shouted to everyone to head for the exits, leave their belongings, and not to wear their shoes. and before Nancy could get to the two children sitting behind them, the Saudi couple had taken off their seatbelts and pulled the children out of their seats. Ahmed put on their life vests as they stared at him.
"Don't be afraid. We will take care of you," he said, holding Nicole in a firm grip.
She was crying, and Mark was close to it. Ahmed and Sadaf got them to the nearest exit, pushed them down the slide toward the part that became a raft and would detach from the slide later, and followed them immediately. They each held one of them on their lap, in the boat bouncing on the choppy water. And all down the length of the plane, the slides were operating. The rafts were inflated, and passengers were sliding out as fast as they could. Catherine wound up in the raft with Ahmed and Sadaf and the two children, and she told them they would be all right. She was more worried about them than she was herself.
"Go,"
Joel said to Nancy as they shepherded their passengers out.
"I'm not leaving till we get them all out," she said fiercely.
"Bobby says you're pregnant. Get down the slide. I'm not leaving little kids and our passengers on this plane. If we make it out of here, you'd better invite me to your wedding.
Promise.
How long do you think we'll float?"
he whispered to her.
"Not long,"
she said honestly. The plane was bouncing on the waves, and water had started to seep into the cabin. They saw Susan Farrow and her dog come down the aisle then, going the wrong way, heading toward coach.
"You've got to get to the slide," Joel said, trying to turn her in the right direction, with the dog sticking his head out of her life vest, which she hadn't inflated yet, since she hadn't left the plane.
"I'm 76 years old. No one's going to miss me if I'm gone. And if they do, they can watch my movies. I'm not leaving these people on a sinking plane. I'm heading back to coach to help," she said, and marched past them before they could stop her.
When she got there, she saw Robert with his baby in a front pack, helping the girls from the chorus down the slide. Their chaperone had been one of the first out, and the girls were crying and panicking, left to their own devices as Bobby and the other crew members and Robert got them all out. There were other passengers with young children, and he helped a dozen of them off, after the girls, before he went down the slide himself. They were all sprayed with the salt water as soon as they got out, and the Coast Guard tenders were all around them, a flotilla of them, lifting people out of the rafts, onto the deck of the Coast Guard rescue boats. The helicopters were hovering to fish anyone out of the water, but so far, miraculously, no one had fallen in. Ahmed had carefully lifted both children into the hands of the Coast Guard rescuers, and then lifted Sadaf up and let the other women pass before him. He was the last one out of his raft, as it danced crazily on the water, but he kept his balance and managed not to fall out. Sadaf burst into tears the moment he reached the deck of the Coast Guard boat and stood sobbing, clinging to him.
"Captain Smith!" Air traffic control checked every few minutes to see if she was still there. She hadn't left the plane yet, and didn't intend to until the last passenger was out. It pained her to see Connor Gray's body in the rising water in the cockpit, but there was nothing they could do for him now. He had lost his life for a noble cause, trying to save her, the passengers, and the plane. He had died a hero's death. What remained of Jason was on the floor near his seat, where he had fallen.
"You need to get out, Captain," air traffic control told her, sounding anxious. She was watching the evacuation from the windows, and they still had people coming down the slides and getting into rafts.
"I'm not leaving till everybody's out," she said firmly. "I think we're almost there. The water is up to my knees now."
"Get out!" the controller shouted at her.
"Not yet. I think we're going down nose first."
It was what she had expected, with the weight of the plane.
"I'm going to check the cabins now."
She left her seat and headed back then. First class was empty, and business class. The crew had moved to the tail section and were all still there, helping the last people down the slides. A woman with two teenage children, a handful of men. Everyone was in shock, but focused on getting out before the plane went down and helping each other. The water level was rising at the back of the plane, too. The last passenger was off, as they stood up to their thighs in the water, and Helen ordered the crew down the last slide and into the life raft. More Coast Guard rescue boats were waiting for them.
"You too, Captain,"
Joel said, as he turned to look at her.
She had Jason's blood all over her shirt, on her face, and in her hair. Nancy was already out of the plane, and Bobby was in a raft with a net, waiting to be picked up along with Jennifer, the purser, who had stayed till the end. The crew had been remarkable. Joel went down the slide next, and was the last person off the plane, except for Helen. She took a final look to make certain everyone was gone, and the plane suddenly sank lower in the water, and the opening to exit from shrank dramatically, and the slide detached. She slipped through the opening into the water, and knew that one of the boats would pick her up, and was surprised to find herself under the water for what seemed like a long time. She was a strong swimmer, and made it through the water, underneath the waves, and then felt a powerful pull trying to take her down deeper with it, and she realized that the plane was sinking. She fought to swim free of it, and had to fight hard. Her lungs felt like they were exploding as she bobbed to the surface. The current had taken her far from the lifeboats, and she tried to float for a few minutes to catch her breath. And then another wave took her down with it, as she wondered if she would come up again. For her children's sake, she hoped she would. But she was sure that Jack had felt that way too before he died. Chapter 11. "Where is she? What do you mean the Coast Guard didn't pick her up? And she's not in the life rafts? She was the last one to leave the plane after the crew," the head of emergency services in San Francisco told Ben, who was pacing in his office, screaming at him. "They never saw her come down the slide. The last one detached just before she got out, and the plane went down. They didn't see her get out before it did." "Well, for Christ's sake, are they looking for her? What are they doing? She's got to be in the water somewhere. She may have been pulled under by the plane if she got out too late. It went down pretty fast, and created a powerful undertow. She may not have been able to swim free of it. We're looking for her. We've got rescue boats in the water and helicopters in the air. If she's out there, they'll find her. She's out there. Find her!" Ben shouted, and hung up for the third time since the rescue had started. They had all been watching it on CNN. The recovery operation had been brilliantly efficient so far. The crew had gotten the passengers out in record time, and had been the last to leave. They didn't have a totally reliable headcount yet, since there were passengers on an assortment of boats as they were being transferred to the Coast Guard ships in the bay, particularly those needing medical attention. Ben wondered if Helen could be one of them, if the numbers they'd been given so far were accurate. They had lost no passengers or crew other than the three pilots, and they knew that two of them were dead. Ben was praying that the third one had survived. It was another hour before Tom Burney called him from one of the Coast Guard boats and told him what had happened in the cockpit in the end. Jason shooting Connor, Helen getting the controls back and then losing them again, and then getting control of the plane in the final minutes, and Jason's dramatic suicide with the plastic gun. Tom said that both Jason's and Connor's bodies had gone down with the plane. For his family's sake, he hoped they would recover Connor Gray's. And Ben was sure they would find Jason's, too, when they pulled up the remains of the plane. It would be a costly operation, but the plane would have to be raised from the ocean floor at the mouth of the bay. The airline and the city would want it removed, before it was dragged out to sea by the currents or became a hazard to incoming boats. The group in Ben's office began to move around. They had been sitting there for hours. It had been a day of agonizing tension that had left all of them drained. But if the passengers had been saved from disaster, it was a major victory, in great part thanks to Helen Smith's and Tom Burney's courageous acts in the cockpit. The CEO of the airline had conferred with Phil several times, and they were preparing a statement to explain the situation to the public. In essence, the flight had been taken over by a mentally disturbed co-pilot, and the passengers had ultimately been saved by the heroic captain, a decorated pilot with long years of military experience as a fighter pilot. But they had some heavy explaining to do as to why someone like Jason was still working for the airline after countless warnings and behavioral problems that they knew about. Ben spoke to Bernice quietly, after ranting at emergency services in San Francisco. She was still sitting there, waiting to see if they would rescue the captain. She hoped they would, but it didn't sound likely. Helicopters and rescue boats were combing the area, with no luck so far. The water was rough, and the current strong under the bridge, and she could have been pulled out to sea, or gone down with the plane.
"I'd like to credit you with finding the postcard and reporting it to us, if that's all right with you,"
Ben said cautiously. "It was brave of you to follow up on it, especially after your supervisor discouraged you from reporting it." Dave Lee had explained the whole sequence of events to him, and he was duly impressed with Bernice's intelligence and determination.
"Could you leave out the part about the supervisor?" she said hesitantly. "She hates me, and she'd probably kill me when I go back to work."
She smiled at him, and he chuckled.
"We can leave out the part about the supervisor," Ben assured her. "You should get a medal for this, or some kind of citation, and a promotion."
He looked warmly at her.
"I'm planning to quit soon," she said quietly. "I've been going to law school online. I'm graduating in June. I'm going to take the bar exam, and I want to get a job in a law firm. That's what I promised my son I'd do."
"You have a child?"
He was surprised. She looked like a kid herself, barely out of her teens.
"I have a 6-year-old son," she said proudly.
She had been touched by how seriously Ben took everything, and how hard he had worked to make the right things happen. And he had believed her. After Denise, he had restored her faith in her fellow man. He wrote down the correct spelling of her name, and she went back to watching the big TV screen with the others as the rescue continued. It was 4 o'clock in San Francisco by then, and 7 in New York. Her neighbor had picked Toby up at daycare, and he was spending the night with them. She didn't know what time she'd get home. The drama wasn't over yet, although the worst was behind them. Ben was upset about Helen, and wishing that a miracle would occur and they'd find her, and so was everyone else. She was one of the main heroes of the day. It wouldn't be right if she didn't survive it, and she would leave 3 orphaned kids behind, since their father had died a hero's death, too. Amanda was watching, too, sobered by everything that had happened. She had a lot to think about, and some decisions to make. Mildred had left by then, and Dave Lee and Phil were among the diehards who didn't want to leave Ben's office until they had the final count of survivors and knew what had happened to Helen. They all were aware that if Helen wasn't picked up soon, she wouldn't be among the survivors.
"Where's Mommy?"
Helen's 7-year-old daughter Lally asked her grandfather as they continued to watch the news in the principal's office. She had brought him coffee and milk and cookies for the children. They had watched all of the passengers lifted from the inflatable rafts onto the Coast Guard boats.
"Is she on one of the big boats?"
Lally asked him, sitting on his lap.
"Not yet," Tim said with an intense look in his eyes. This couldn't happen to them again. Life couldn't be that cruel to leave all 3 of them orphans at such a young age. Oliver was 13, Jimmy was 11, and Lally 7. One of Lally's feet dragged slightly, and her right arm was weaker than her left. But other than that, she was a busy, active, happy child, and never let her slight disability slow her down. She looked somber now, though, as they waited to hear of Helen's rescue. But nothing came.
"Are there sharks in the bay?"
Oliver asked his grandfather in a whisper, not wanting the others to hear. "I'm sure they aren't that close to land," he said in a reassuring tone, but he'd always heard there were. He hadn't even thought of that till then.
"If she's on one of the big boats," Lally insisted, "why don't they show her on TV?"
She wanted to believe that her mother had made it to one of the Coast Guard boats. "Because everyone there is very busy right now," Tim said reasonably, keeping an eye on his middle grandchild. Jimmy hadn't said a word for hours. He just kept staring at the TV. Tim wanted to get them home, but he didn't want to miss anything while they were in the car. The news reports kept playing over and over the video footage of when the plane went down and disappeared under the water with a terrible sucking sound. He could easily imagine his daughter being pulled under with it, with a force that she couldn't fight. The children's faces were pale when the principal looked in on them again, But Tim had a kind of dogged determination as he comforted the children and refused to believe his daughter had died. Tom, Bernie, and Catherine had become separated while he helped others out of the plane and down the slides, but he knew she had made it into the first raft and was on one of the Coast Guard boats. No one had been taken to shore yet. They were being treated for minor injuries by the Coast Guard teams that had picked them up, and Tom knew he'd catch up with Catherine sooner or later. Ahmed and Sadaf were on a Coast Guard cutter with the two children they helped rescue, Mark and Nicole. They had been allowed to call their mother to tell her they were on the boat and were fine. Their mother sobbed when one of the officers talked to her. She said it had been the worst day of her life, and her parents were waiting for news of them at their home in Orinda. She gave the officer their number, and he promised to have someone call them when they docked, which wouldn't be for several hours. He assured her again that they were in good hands and hadn't been injured during the rescue. He said that Mark had just eaten a hamburger, and Nicole wanted pizza, and would be eating shortly. The crew members were taking good care of them, and so had Ahmed and Sadaf during the rescue, who hadn't let them out of their sight. Nancy and Joel were picked up by the same boat somewhat later, and they were all happy to see each other. And Nancy was relieved to see that the children had done well, and the Saudi couple had taken responsibility for them during the rescue. No one had expected the flight to end as it had when it left New York that morning. Bobby and Jennifer and most of the flight attendants had wound up in a life raft together when it detached from the slide, and from there they had been transferred to a Coast Guard boat. "So, are you going to invite me to your wedding?" Nancy teased Joel again. He had called Kevin from the rescue boat, and his future husband had sobbed piteously when he heard Joel's voice. "I thought you were dead when I saw that plane go down. Thank God you're all right." "I'm fine," Joel told him gently. "It was scary as hell, but we were busy reassuring the passengers and getting them out." "You can be my matron of honor if you want," Joel said to Nancy when she mentioned the wedding. "I'd like that," she said, looking across the bay at the city she thought she'd never see again. She hadn't talked to her husband yet. His flight from Miami was due to land shortly. She wondered if she'd lose the baby after everything she'd just been through, but it couldn't be helped. She was alive, and she had Peter and the little girl they were going to adopt in China. Maybe that was all she needed. She suddenly felt extraordinarily lucky. She had stared death in the face and survived it. She and Joel stood on the deck of the Coast Guard boat, and he had his arm around her. She suspected they would be friends forever after this. They had been to hell and back together. They brought out an obstetrician by helicopter to examine her, and she said that everything appeared to be in good order. She had no cramps or bleeding, although the doctor told her to take it easy for the next several days. But all was well so far. Susan Farrow had wound up in the life raft with Robert and his baby, the girls from the chorus, and Monique Lalou, who was disgraced after abandoning her charges on the plane. She made a number of weak excuses, but the truth was that she had been terrified and wanted to save herself and forgot about the girls. The girls, Monique and Annette, the flight attendant, wound up on one of the Coast Guard cutters together. Robert had called Ellen from the Coast Guard boat and apologized to her for taking the baby from her that morning. He was sorry about it now, and he sounded remorseful. He had almost gotten them both killed. He knew he wouldn't take the flight to Japan that night. Ellen still sounded frantic, and said she'd never recover from the shock of finding the baby gone. "That was a terrible thing to do to your wife," Susan said seriously when he told her about it. "You have to give the baby back now." He was sleeping peacefully in his father's arms then, and no longer seemed feverish, even after being exposed to wind and water. "It was all so much harder than I thought it would be when we had him. She changed after she was pregnant. She was always telling me what to do, like I was a kid or something." "Maybe you acted like one," the actress said honestly. "Maybe she grew up and you didn't." "I'm not sure I want to," he said, thinking about it. "She'll probably never speak to me again." "I'm not sure I would either. Stealing him from her was a pretty nasty thing to do."
He nodded and didn't answer. The authorities had already contacted the airline and emergency rescue services, and when they got to shore, Child Protective Services were taking the baby into custody. The baby's mother would be there in the morning to get him. She was flying out from New York. The girls from the chorus were badly shaken by what had happened, and their chaperone said she intended to give notice. She knew the parents would fire her anyway when the girls told them how she had behaved, leaving them on the plane during the rescue. One of the mothers was coming out to continue the tour with the girls. Ms. Lalou insisted that she wanted to be admitted to a hospital when they landed, and said she wasn't up to continuing the trip, nor the job as the girls' chaperone. They were too much for her to handle. The couple that had argued the entire flight were on a different boat. They had been separated in the life rafts, and each thought the other hadn't survived. When they found each other on the same Coast Guard boat, they realized how far they'd fallen and how badly they'd let each other down. And whatever happened in the future, they agreed they weren't ready to give up on their marriage yet.
"I thought you were dead,"
she sobbed in his arms as she clung to him. Tears rolled down his cheeks, and he admitted that he had thought she was dead too. They hadn't solved their problems and didn't know if they would, but being together was enough for now. They felt like they'd been given another chance and didn't want to waste it. And maybe they could work it out. They promised each other they'd try. The bridge was still closed at 8 o'clock that night, but they were planning to open it at midnight. Most of the emergency vehicles had left, except for a few ambulances and police cars. The fire trucks were gone and hadn't been needed, and the Phoenix had returned to port earlier. Arrangements had been made to take those who needed it to local hospitals for minor injuries, and the airline had made hotel reservations for everyone else. Representatives from the airline were waiting on shore with buses, and clothing had been provided for all of them, at the airline's expense. And local passengers would be going home if they didn't need to be admitted to hospitals for injuries sustained during the rescue. There had been some cuts and bruises, a broken ankle, and some sprains. Two passengers with serious heart problems were being treated by Coast Guard doctors, and an elderly person had been taken to UCSF by helicopter. But on the whole, they had fared surprisingly well in spite of the trauma and near-death experience. There would be months of trauma-related disorders and post-traumatic stress to deal with, and counseling for the crew. The survivors' recovery would be a huge undertaking. Legal issues would have to be decided and dealt with, including whatever restitution by the airline was deemed appropriate. There were bound to be lawsuits, no matter how well it had been handled, and questions asked forever about why Jason hadn't been dismissed earlier, at the first sign of his behavioral problems, which had ultimately led to this horror and the cold-blooded murder of a respected senior captain. Connor's family would undoubtedly sue the airline, too. They were expecting it, and all the other lawsuits passengers and their families would file against them. It would be a long, arduous process, and take years. Ben, Phil, Bernice, and Amanda were still watching the continuing reports on TV in Ben's office, hoping to hear of Helen's rescue. But there had been no further news of it by 8:30 after a press conference. The final survivor count was in by then. No lives had been lost except Connor Gray, Jason Andrews, and possibly Helen Smith, the three pilots. The rest of the crew and all the passengers had survived. The rescue had been extraordinarily successful, and Helen's artful landing had saved the passengers and the bridge. She was already being declared a hero. The CEO of the airline and head of PR had held a press conference at 8 o'clock, explaining what had happened as best they could, and apologizing to the passengers and their families for the trauma they had endured. They concluded by praising the captain and crew for their heroic acts during the rescue that had resulted in all the passengers surviving, and they expressed the hope that Captain Helen Smith would be found. Every effort was being made by the Coast Guard in a continuing search and rescue mission to find her at sea and in the bay. Tom Birney had declined to be interviewed, but the press were camped outside his apartment once they heard about him. It was too soon for anyone to talk. The anchormen on all the news stations were starting to repeat the same things over and over, focusing on the most dramatic elements. Helen's water landing under the bridge had been shown again and again. Helicopters were still sweeping over the area, looking for Helen, and a final report said that after 9 o'clock that night, search efforts would be suspended.